Weirdly and Tori here. Just wanted to pop in and tell you guys a little bit about the BarkBox Super Chewer Box. With two Super Chewers in my house, I've spent hundreds of dollars trying out all kinds of, quote, indestructible toys, all of which were destructed in mere minutes of meeting my dogs. Emily had suggested BarkBox to me, but I thought there was no way that these toys were going to hold up to my dogs. But then she told me about the Super Chewer Box, so we decided to try it. Even with the Super Chewer Box, though, my dog Hodor had destroyed one of the toys, though it did take him longer than normal. Emily suggested I reach out to BarkBox, and I'm so glad that I did. Their amazing customer service listened to my concerns and helped me customize the type of toys and treats that I receive, and it's been smooth sailing ever since. But Super Chewer isn't just toys. You get treats and chews in every box, and you can buy extra toys and treats from their website. My dogs are like my kids, and it's Christmas every month when that BarkBox arrives. If you follow the link in our show notes, you'll get double your first box. If you have a Super Chewer, this is the box for you, and your pup will thank you.
Hello and welcome. Thank you. What the fuck? We'll just restart that. Bloop, 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 bloop. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Three's a Crime, a true crime podcast. I'm Tori.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Lindsay.
And that's our intro.
Here we are. We are professional. Professional podcasters.
We're podcasters, bitches.
Welcome.
It's a Tori story.
Tori story. Emily made chicken parmesan and spaghetti, like spaghetti bake. It's just so fucking good. Bread. Michael's bread.
Oh, Michael's bread.
So good. So today, I'm going to start off with a little disclaimer.
Okay.
Okay. This might be one of the most controversial stories that we as a podcast have told.
Really?
And as I get into it, you're going to see why. So I say, I'm going to say this to make it clear that the opinions that I state during this episode, and let me tell you, I have some opinions.
This bitch always has some opinions.
Those opinions are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of my fellow podcasters. And I'm not sure how I missed this story because it was massive in 2020. And I don't know if it's because
it was
COVID was dominating the news or if I was avoiding the news because of COVID, but I did not know this story.
I'm surprised if anybody remembers 2020.
Right.
It's really just a blur.
So our story today is about the murder of three police officers back in, I believe it was 2004. And then the trials of their accused murderers, Nathaniel Woods and Carrie Spencer. So first I'm going to talk about Nathaniel Woods. So Nate, or Quell, as his family called him, was born October 24th, 1976 in Alabama. He spent his early childhood in Tuscaloosa with his two sisters, Heavenly and Pamela. Nate was the oldest. By all accounts, he had a pretty tough childhood. His parents split up in part because his mother, who was also named Pamela, thought that the best way to discipline her children was to basically beat the living shit out of them.
So we have a Pam Sr. and a Pam Jr. Yeah.
Okay. So we have Mother Pam.
Mother Pam.
Mother
Pam. That motherfucking Mother Pam.
Now, Mother Pam is very adamant that she was not an abusive parent.
That's usually
that she, she was just, this was just discipline.
She was just speaking the truth.
But she was quoted in a New York Times article saying,
I told the police, if I can't whoop their ass, then they need to take them to jail or take me, because ain't no child going to run my house when I'm getting up and going to work two jobs taking care of them. All I get is, you mean, you hateful, you abuse us. Now, look, I get it. I get that perhaps Mother Pam mm-hmm. was doing the best that she could, but she felt, she also said that she was only whipping them, and it wasn't abuse because she wasn't leaving Perusine.
Oh. What time frame is this?
This would be late 70s, early 80s, okay. When they were, you know, he was born in 76.
Right. That's what I thought.
Both of his sisters and their father confirmed that the treatment of her children was abusive. So while she denies it, they back it up.
It's usually how
it goes. And as a young boy, he used to, like, take care of, like, little stray animals. And and if his mother was beating on one of his sisters, they said that he would be like, no, mama, beat me instead.
Oh, Jesus
So Christ. It was this upbringing that his sister said made him feel like he needed to be, like, the caretaker of everyone.
Right.
So Nate ended up leaving school after the sixth grade. His father brought him to come live with him in Ensley, Alabama, which is, like, it's a neighborhood of Birmingham. So I think it's considered Birmingham. I wasn't really clear because it's like 11 minutes outside, so it's almost like being on the north side.
Okay.
Or whatever. So it's more of an Ensley neighborhood than like a suburb.
Okay.
But I don't know. If you're from Alabama, let me know. But I'm going to say some shit about Alabama today, so
Betsy,
don't get mad at me.
It's from Alabama.
Oh, yeah. All right, Bets.
Tell us what you think.
So his father brought him to come and live in Ensley because of the abuse that he was suffering at home. And that's something that his father said he now wonders if that was the right thing to do, you know, like,
would
he have
him?
Been safer where he was God. Based on how things turn out for him in this story.
Oh, God.
So Nate was young and he didn't have a high school diploma, but his sister said that he was a hard worker and he'd do anything. He did fast food, construction, whatever. He was really handy with electronics. Now, this is not to say that Nate was an angel or without fault. He had been arrested for burglary, reckless driving, public drinking. But he'd gotten a job at a Piggly Wiggly warehouse where his dad worked, operating a forklift. But it didn't last. And it doesn't, there's no explanation of why, how he lost his job, but he just did. At 28, he was a father of three.
Wow.
With no formal training.
That's me having a father of three.
That'd be me with three kids. He was your age. So he had no formal training. And so when he lost his job, he went to work for his cousin, Bubba.
Oh, Bubba.
A drug dealer.
Hi, Bubba.
Now, Nate didn't want to be dealing drugs. He literally was just doing it until he could find another job. But
yes,
you know, and I'm again not advocating or excusing drug dealers, but I think there are a lot of people that get into doing this because they don't, you know, it's like with sex work. Sometimes you just don't have another option.
I was going to say, like, sex work or stripping a lot of times.
Yeah.
Or it's to pay for something. It's like a temporary.
Right. Yeah. And I'm not saying that that's always the case or anything like that. Some people choose that lifestyle.
Yeah.
But my point in mentioning this is that Nate didn't want to be involved in this lifestyle, but it was where he was.
Yeah.
There were parts of your Patreon story where we were talking about some of the abuse that, like,
yeah,
that Conrad the Third suffered at the hands of Conrad
Junior. Yeah.
Was like, this is just discipline.
Yeah, it's this is, same, I was being, you know, a dad. I'd do it again if I could.
Exactly. You know, so there's some weird overlap, which is why it's just really, as I go
that
through it,
interesting.
I think you'll see. But anyway, so it worked like this. Bubba would buy the drugs in bulk, and it was usually either crack cocaine or marijuana. And then Nate and this other guy, Carrie Spencer, were responsible for selling it. And they were like nickel and dime bags, which is $5 or $10 in case you aren't not up on your drug lingo.
I was not up on my drug lingo. So thank you, man.
So a dime bag would be $10. Though apparently Nate wasn't a very good drug dealer because most times he'd either give away the drugs or give away the money trying to help the person he was trying to sell the drugs to.
Oh, no.
And his sister said that that was just rooted in his need to try to take care of people.
Yeah.
Now, Carrie Spencer, who was 25, the other low-level drug dealer working for Bubba, his real name is Tyran Cooper. Nope. Yes. Bubba's real name is Tyran Cooper. Oh. But Carrie Spencer, 25, was in a very similar... he had a very similar upbringing, right? Mm-hmm. He, too, had left school early. He worked in that Piggly Wiggly warehouse. He had three children.
Wow.
However, unlike Nate, Carrie also had a very expensive coke habit.
Oh, God.
And also was a had a fondness for guns. He was almost always armed. So these were, you know, these were two guys doing the same thing, raised in very different circumstances, but very different personalities.
Yeah.
So on June 17th, 2004, Carrie and Nate were both in an Ensley apartment that was used as a drug house. Somewhere around 9 to 10 a.m. Now, the officer says 9, but this officer, Michael Collins, who I'm going to talk about, said 9 a.m. And then, but other sources, I said, have it, like, time-stamped, like, 10:30 a.m. kind of thing. So, okay. About 9 a.m., police officer Michael Collins hears on over the radio that Officer Carlos Owen was at the location of that Ensley apartment. When Officer Collins rolled up around 10:30, Officer Owen told him that the man behind the locked screen door at this house or apartment had supposedly told him to get the fuck off his property. Apparently, he had come to the house and he had asked the man to come outside and the man wouldn't come outside. So if I understand it correctly, if the police show up at your house without a warrant, they're kind of like vampires, right? Either you have to invite them in,
yeah,
or you have to come out.
Oh my God, I've never heard it like that.
As soon as you would take a step outside, like, they could arrest you.
I did not know that at all.
Yeah. So Nate's like, fuck you, dude. I'm not coming outside.
Yeah.
So during this initial meeting, Officer Owen asked the man behind the screen door what his name was, and the man replied, Nathaniel Woods. So Officer Owen meets up with Officer Collins. Now, Carrie would later say that Nate gave the police his name because he didn't think he had anything on him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I'm not scared of you. My name's Nathaniel Woods. Now, Officer Collins decides to run Nate's name. Now, he says in an interview that he didn't know, Officer Collins says he didn't know anybody inside that house, not even by their street name, right? So, mm-hmm. didn't know Bubba, didn't know, and I think Carrie went by, like, Nuke or Nuki, and Nathaniel Woods,
yeah.
Nate or Quell. So,
how? Why were they even there then? If they didn't, he didn't. Okay, okay.
We are gonna get
Tori literally, like, put her hand up. Like, don't you worry.
Yeah,
we're gonna get there.
Tori with that.
So Officer Collins decides he's gonna run Nate's name, and a couple of hours later, it comes back with a misdemeanor warrant for assault from another town from 4 months prior, but it didn't matter. The officers now have an in, okay? Yeah. This is an important point, so I want you guys to remember, like, this whole deal. The fact that they ran his name, and then they found a warrant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, with their warrant, officers Owens and Collins, along with officers Harley Chisholm III and Charles Bennett, returned to the apartment to serve the warrant and arrest Nate. The series of events that happen next depend on who you believe. Mm. But the result was that 3 of the 4 officers lost their lives that day, and Nathaniel Woods and Carrie Spencer were arrested for capital murder.
Jesus.
The 3 officers that died that day were Carlos Curly Owens, who was 58. Now, Carlos was known around town by the nickname Curly because, like, in the 70s, 80s, he had that super curly, permed hair. So even now, he, like, you know, he's an older gentleman and he doesn't have that. But, like, everybody still called him Curly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was the oldest, and he was just 2 years from retirement.
Oh, fuck.
Harley Chisholm was 40, and he was also known as RoboCop or Robo.
Oh, no.
And then finally, Charles Bennett, who was the youngest of the three. He didn't have a nickname.
Oh, sad.
These nicknames are gold, though.
Right?
Yeah, man.
So Andrea Elders is the daughter, the adult daughter of Carlos Owen. Now, she said she was daddy's girl. Like, he was the one that always, like, you know, took her to dances or took her to get her ears pierced. Like, she said her father was very well known around town. Even if it was only just because of the curly hair, like, yeah. She was like, people would notice him, knew him in and out of uniform. He had been born and raised in Ensley, and he made people in his community feel safe. His daughter said that his biggest goal as a police officer was to get drugs off the street. He was known for community policing at its finest, and he used to deliver bikes to disadvantaged kids.
Wow.
He was repeatedly honored for his police work, and in 2002, he won Officer of the Year. But the residents of this neighborhood say that they knew a different Curly. Mm-hmm. They said that if he liked you, he'd help you out. Like, not taking you to jail, like giving you a pass. Or if he had to take you to jail, stopping along the way so that you could stash or ditch your drugs so you didn't have to have them on you when he took you in.
Wow.
One lady said she was like, I had a big old bag of paraphernalia. And she said Curly let her hide it in the sewer. And so she was like, and as soon as I got out, I went right back there and fished it out.
I'm telling you, I just need to say something. If you know a cop who tells you that he'll do that, red flag.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very big,
like,
red flag.
Listen, okay? I don't give a fuck who you are. You don't help people get away with crimes. Nope.
Well,
you don't hide shit.
There was so for the research for this, there's an amazing documentary, which I stumbled upon, which is how I found this, called To Live and Die in Alabama. And there's a fabulous New York, and that was presented by the New York Times, but there's also a very fabulous New York Times article. And I'm going to be honest, the two of these things, like, they had so much of the information condensed in one area that I was just like, I did use some other sources, but most of them were articles after the conviction. One of the guys in this, and he doesn't say what cop it was, but how, like, he was stopped by a cop. The guy had dope on him. The cop took the dope, told him, all right, go on, get out of here, and just kept it. And he was like, what fucking cop does that? Like,
me as a cop.
Yeah, probably.
The I'm ones like, on you.
It's a good thing that you got it there. Not part of the Spokane Police Department.
On the televisions, they do it.
Right? So, and so that leads me to my next point, is that other folks in town just say straight up, Curly was a drug dealer. Wow. If he caught you with dope, he'd take it from you and give it to his guys to sell.
That's insane.
Now, Curly's daughter, Andrea, adamant that this is not true. Yeah. He was not a dirty cop. She said he'd been on the police force for 26 years, and if he'd been dirty, it would have come out before he died and couldn't defend himself. And I will be completely honest, and I'm going to stop here at this point and say, I do not have any opinions, or I'm not, I actually do have multiple opinions, but I am not going to voice any opinions about whether or not, as we go through this, that I think that the police officers did or did not commit any misdeeds. I am presenting both sides of the argument. People can decide for themselves what they believe. And I have this in here later, but I'll say it preemptively now, that it has to be noted that none of the officers involved that we're going to talk about were ever formally accused or charged with anything. Does that mean that they were innocent? No. It just means that they weren't formally charged. That I'm going to be respectful of that, and I'm not making any assumptions. So the next police officer, Harley Chisholm, the third, he was also known as RoboCop. He was just a few days from turning 41. He was 6'4", like, just and, like, he and Curly, I don't know if they were partners or just were normally with each other. I mean, they're all out, all of these guys are out of the same precinct. But it's just, like, he was, like, a big, hulking man that wore, like, wraparound sunglasses.
Oh, that's why he's RoboCop.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I didn't see RoboCop, so I didn't know, so thanks for letting me know that. So I was like, I don't know why he's just like RoboCop.
I'll show you a picture while you
look. I mean, I remember, like, I remember vaguely what RoboCop looks like. I just never saw the movies. Harley's sister, Star, wrote to the New York Times and said, he knew when to police from the book and when to police from the heart. He chose to work in one of the badass areas to help make it a better place for the community. In 2001, he was named West Precinct's Officer of the Year. That said, he was also disciplined for some not-so-great police work. A year, just a year after winning, or West Precinct's Officer of the Year, he was suspended when he admitted to opening a woman's trunk, dousing some baby clothes with beer from bottles that he had broken, and then used a knife to break a TV that was in her vehicle.
What the fuck?
What?
There was no context for that information other than...
Here's the information.
Here's the information. But, I mean, he...
Damn.
It sounds... And especially when, like, you know, even his sister is saying, he knew when to police from the heart and when to police from the book. I'm just like, so you know he wasn't always by the book? Is that what that means? I don't know. Anyway. Officer Chisholm was often with Curly. And because everybody refers to them that way... I think I'm going to just...
That's fine.
It'll be RoboCop and Curly, so we know who I'm talking about. But they were often together, and one Inslee resident said, there may be people in the neighborhood who loved cops, but even they would tell you that Curly and Robo were pieces of shit.
Wow.
So there is a disparity there between what their family's characterization versus people in the neighborhood they were policing. Now, that said, there was another, you know... A few of the ladies that they interviewed in the documentary were like, I'm not going to say nothing bad about Curly. You know, he let me get off on some things a few times, which
still, like, is it's that a still positive a red or flag. Negative? It's That's still, your, you know, red flag. Right.
Like, if you're going to do it to help someone out for something small, I just, nope, that's.
It's like, don't trust the Shield. I mean, it reminds me of the Shield a little bit with the bad cop.
Well, and I mean.
In charge.
And Curly had gone up to one of the guys that they interview in this and had offered him $500 to, like, follow him around. He's like, I'm going to give you $500. I want you to go door to door and try to buy drugs so that I can bust people that are selling drugs. And so I'm like, you know, but I mean, like, that just sounds like somebody working a CI, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, you get your CI, confidential informants often get paid for the work that they do by the officers that they're working for. But then I was just like, or... Was he like, I'm going to give you $500, you show me which houses to bust, and then I'm going to steal their drugs, and then I'm going to resell them. So I don't know. Also, it should be said that the chief of police has also come out and said, like, that these are just rumors and that rumors are distraction. And, you know, if somebody has proof of illegal activity, why have they never brought it forward, essentially? So
okay.
There you go.
I was going to say there's no record of a CI and, like...
That
I mean, like, official. There's not an official.
Who knows?
Okay.
So now the final officer that died that day was Officer Bennett. He was 33.
Ooh.
He was married and he had a 4-year-old daughter. This one genuinely breaks my heart. So Officer Bennett, residents genuinely seemed to like him. Like, they did not think of him the same way they thought of Curly and Robo. And they, you know, they talked about him being courteous and professional, that he was a good cop, that he seemed to genuinely care about the neighborhood. And it was just a shame that he got caught up in this mess with Curly and RoboCop.
Yeah.
The reason that I mentioned this disparity in the descriptions of character for at least Curly and RoboCop is because depending upon what you believe about them and about what I'm about to tell you, it might make a difference. So we're going to go back to Nate's cousin, Bubba. So he wrote an affidavit. This was entered into both cases. Nate's cousin, Bubba, the one who was running the drug operation, has claimed since that day that he had been paying RoboCop and Curly $1,000 a week for protection. They would tip him off when drug busts were going to go down, especially for him. And it also kept their competition low because they were busting other drug dealers, which made them you know.
Yeah.
Supply and demand.
More, yeah.
And he specifically said, how do you think that I got away with this for so long without getting caught?
Like, yeah.
They were feeding me the information. But the officers came back to Bubba and said, you know what, $1,000 is not enough. They wanted $1,500 a piece. And so Bubba was like, fuck you. Like, I'm not. They just stopped paying them.
So they fucking are mafia style right now.
Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing. I mean, the way that Bubba is describing the arrangement is very similar to other cases I know of in, like, New York or whatever. Because, like, in the 70s and 80s, the New York Police Department was, like, more corrupt than not corrupt.
Yeah.
Same with the LAPD.
Yeah, oh exactly. God, yeah. And so a lot of those cops were taking bribes. And, and it worked kind of just like this. Again, I am not saying that these police officers were corrupt. I am just saying.
This is the information.
This is the information. And I can see. I can see it.
Yeah.
I can see that happening.
Yeah.
So now I'm going to tell you Carrie and Nate's version of events, and then we'll talk about Michael Collins' version of events. He is the one officer that survived that day, and he is one of my least favorite characters in this story. Because I will go on record, since he did not die, I will go on record and say something's wrong with that guy and that guy's story. It's just done. Anyway. Okay, so police records indicate that Curly clocked in for work that day at 6:30 a.m. Carrie and Nate claimed that Curly had pulled his truck up at dawn in front of the apartment on his way to work and kicked at their door demanding to talk to Bubba, but when they didn't come to the door, he finally left. Now, the precinct is literally half a mile from this drug house.
Oh, my God.
Like, down the block, okay? So this is possible.
Yeah.
A neighbor stated that, as far as she knew, neither Nate or Carrie had been in the apartment that morning. But she had heard from another neighbor that Officer Owen had indeed been there. But overall, they were like, well, that's not corroborated. Now, this is official. So at 10:30, Curly and RoboCop arrive back at the drug house. Or they arrive at the drug house, right? So it's the first time for Robo that day. They claimed to be... Why are you guys laughing at me?
Because just the way I said...
Just the way you said the sentence, yeah. Uh-huh. It's the first time Robo had
been there that day.
Been there. Well, that day.
I know.
That day. Just, that day. I don't know.
She always is like, why are you guys laughing at me? And we're always like, you just said something a little giggly.
Yeah.
You just said something funny.
It was just a little funny.
They arrived back at the drug house. They claimed that they were looking for stolen cars. Mm-hmm. Why? I mean, like...
I don't know. Okay. Mm-hmm. We just thought... Okay.
Oh, yeah, we're here. So.
Hey, that place is down the street. Let's go see if they have any stolen items, like a car, perhaps.
And I mean, my brain says, yeah, it makes sense. Curly probably went there at like 6:30 in the morning, like, hey, bitch, I want my money.
Yeah.
And then it was like, okay, let's go back down there at 10:30.
I want my money.
So they try to get the guys to come out, and they're like, we're not doing it. So. A heated verbal exchange happens, and it's funny because, like, when Carrie's on the stand, they ask him about it, and he's like, it wasn't a pleasant conversation. in a video recorded, like, statement that he did, like, from his jail cell, he's like, oh, yeah, he's like, we were calling the officers fuckboys and little pussies.
Oh, my God.
But then the officers responded by calling them the N-word. And then at some point, Curly briefly just, like, took off his badge, like, not a cop right now. So,
oh, wow.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Officer Collins arrived and ran Nate's name. And Nate and Carrie, they're still inside because they're just like, we're not coming out. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not dumb. You don't have a warrant. You don't have a right to be here. Mm-mm. Get out of here.
You have no reason to search for a stolen car. Like, there's no even probable cause.
Yeah. No. Yeah. No. And so, they run Nate's name. And now... the cops leave to go do that. And Nate and Carrie are in the apartment trying to, you know, basically hide whatever evidence they can. So then Carrie's like, man, I popped a Seroquel, pounded a Bud Light, and I went to bed. And he did it with his semi-automatic rifle close by. And I read in one of the articles, it was something like he had just gotten that semi-automatic rifle, which he paid for. With, he gave, it was like a trade. The guy, whoever gave it to him, for a pistol, $35 and a half gram of coke. That was the purchase price of this semi-automatic rifle.
God, of course.
Do you think you got a receipt?
Yeah.
Right. Half gram of coke. Just sign here.
So like I said, the officers left, and a few hours later, they get confirmation that Nate is wanted in connection with a domestic disturbance from 4 months prior, and back to the house they go. Curly goes to the back screen door and yells that he has an outstanding warrant for Nate's arrest, and he needs to come outside. Nate refused. Officer Chisholm, so RoboCop, came from the front yard into the backyard with the warrant, and Officer Collins claims that Nate yelled some profanity and turned and ran farther back into the apartment. When he did so, RoboCop followed him, as did Curly, and then Officer Collins behind him. Now, here's where things get confusing. So up to that point, that's everybody kind of agrees that that's what happened.
Okay.
This is where things
get fishy.
Right. So Carrie says he woke up from his sleeping pill Bud Light slumber to a commotion. An interview he recorded from his cell. He says he gets up, goes over to the window, sees a bunch of cop cars, and goes, "Aw, shit." It
made me laugh.
It's not funny what's about to happen, but. So as Carrie is coming out of the bedroom, Nate's coming by and going into the kitchen, and he's holding his face like he's in pain, and Carrie's like, "Oh, shit, he's been maced." Out of the corner of his eye, Carrie sees movement, and then he notices there are two officers with their guns trained on him, and he was like, "I just started shooting." He was like, "I wasn't."
Oh, shit.
He's like, "I wasn't even aiming at them at first." He's like, "Probably had a couple rounds in the floor." And he said he was just in defense mode and he didn't stop shooting until they were on the ground.
Wow.
Those officers were RoboCop and Curly.
Holy shit.
He also nicked, Michael Collins in the arm, as he was trying to get out the back door. Now, during this time, Nate later told the police that he was in shock and that he said, "I was hollering, telling them to stop, stop, stop." Carrie then said someone else kicked in the door. That would be young Officer Bennett. And Carrie said the room just lit up.
Oh, my God.
Then he saw an officer who had his gun aimed at Nate. So he knocked Nate out of the way and shot the officer 3 times in the chest torso area. That was Bennett. Nate took off. There's a couple parts that really hit me hard, and this is one of them. So Nate took off because he wanted no part of this, and Carrie understood. Like, he wasn't even mad about it. But on his way out, Nate later told officers that Officer Bennett was, like, laying there and just was like, "Oh, I've been hit." But Nate didn't stop. He kept running. Now, again, I'm like, okay, I kind of understand from Nate's point of view. It's like, "I can't do anything for you, bro. I got to get the fuck out of here."
Yeah.
Like, and freaked out. And, you know, like, because they've gone from, like, nothing happening to, like, 3 cops dead.
Just instant chaos.
But at the same time, it's like, in a matter of moments, it's like 3 people are dead. And here's this young guy that's like, "Hey, I've been hit," who's basically asking for help, and you just left him. So Carrie peeked out the back door and saw an officer just standing there. Wasn't on his radio, just standing. And Carrie was like, I think he was so calm because he assumed that the gunshots in the house were the police. The
police, yeah.
He said he went outside, the officer saw him. Carrie said he gave him a look, and it was like a look of like, "Don't make me do it." Carrie then sprayed a patrol car with bullets in an attempt to scare off Officer Collins. Then he runs back through the house, runs out the front door, and he feels like an officer on the ground, like, touch his leg. And so he looks and he just shoots that officer in the face, drops the rifle and takes off running. And that officer was Officer Bennett.
Oh, Jesus.
So like that one, I'm,
whoa,
it's the, like,
he's,
I
just caught in this shit show.
I mean, basically every, I mean, like, there wasn't even a smidgen of insinuation that Officer Bennett was into anything. Like, everybody was just like, he was amazing.
There's always that in these stories.
Okay. So obviously, when you kill three cops, a manhunt is going to ensue.
Absolutely.
And apparently, Nate was watching the.
And I mean, it was chaos, right? Because you've got like
SWAT is now there, and all the neighbors are out, and like. Some of the neighbors were hooping and hollering and having a party because, you know, they don't trust the cops. They don't like the cops. And now a bunch of cops are dead. And they're like, yeah, fuck the cops. Fuck the police. It was chaos.
Yeah.
But while that whole scene was going on, apparently Nate was sitting on a porch diagonal across the street watching the whole thing.
Oh, my.
Now, on one hand, I'm like, bro, you might want to get a little bit farther away from the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other hand, I'm like, I don't know. Was it smart? He was hiding in plain sight. Because there were a ton of people were all out wondering what was going on. But it was obviously not that smart because he was identified and immediately surrendered. Now, Nate was adamant from the get-go that he was not involved in this in any way other than that he was just there when it went down. And the thing is, Carrie, from the very beginning, backed Nate 100% in that. Mm. He was just like, this was a split second decision that I made. He had, you know, I didn't know I was going to do it. How could he have known I was going to do it? Now, Michael Collins, so the only surviving officer, he claimed that he believes Curly was trying to get Nate to come out, that he stated that they were there, when they were there at the door, Curly said three times, step outside, you got a warrant, you're under arrest to Nate. Collins then claims that all of the sudden, Nate decided to go inside the house. And I think he means, like, farther. Because at first I was just like, well, wait a minute. Was he outside or was he inside? If he was outside, you could have arrested him. What do you mean run inside the house? But I think he means Nate was on the side of a locked screen door. And he ran back, like, from the door into the house. And when he did that, when he turned like he was going to run, is when RoboCop grabbed the door and then started to run in. Now, when Officer Collins is giving his statement, the officer that's interviewing him specifically asks him what I think is a leading question of, okay, you think Nathaniel was trying to get y'all to come into the apartment?
Oh, my God.
To which Collins responded, in my opinion, yes. He wanted us. He acted, he instigated, you know, the first conversation. He gave us his name. And in my opinion, he wanted us to come into that apartment.
Mm-mm. Now, look, that does not make any fucking sense.
No.
Right? Collins, and then later the prosecution, their whole thing is that Nate and Carrie lured the police into the house, basically so that they could ambush them. Now, I'm sorry, but I don't think that there is a criminal out there that knows he has a warrant, is going to give the cops his real name, like, ooh, come get me.
Yeah. No. You're not going to lure that into their home.
No. Nor does it make any sense that if you were going to ambush three cops, that you would do it half a mile from their fucking precinct.
Yeah.
Like, this just makes zero sense to me. And it's really, I just got the feeling that Michael Collins said what he was told to say.
That's the first thought I had when you told me he survived and what happened. Mm. That's honestly the first.
Yeah. Now, this was written. I'm going to read it exactly how it was written in the documentary because I'm sure they consulted legal departments. So in that documentary, To Live and Die in Alabama, it said, Michael Collins has not been accused of participating in any bribery scheme and no evidence has emerged suggesting his involvement. Don't know what it is about Michael Collins, but if you happen to watch that documentary, I feel confident that you're going to see what I saw. What which was the really documentary on? It's on Hulu,
and it's called "Life
to Live and Die in Alabama."
And I told these guys every time I say Alabama, all I can think of because it's one of my favorite lines in Forrest Gump, and it's you know. Jenny's getting ready to leave on our bus, and he's like, you know what I think? I think you should come home to Greenbelt, Alabama! And so that's how I hear Alabama in my head.
Greenbelt. I forget about that, but that Alabama. Now will happen in my brain.
So as I said, both Carrie and Nate ended up being charged with capital murder, even though Nate didn't kill anyone. So little legal sidebar here. And then I wrote, get it?
Sidebar.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Was this when
like how people wrote make, last make night dad this jokes?
This was last night when I was like really deliriously like so tired. But for anybody that doesn't know or doesn't watch Law & Order religiously like Lindsay and I, they were able to charge Nate under the premise of accomplice liability. Accomplice liability is where someone is a participant in a crime even if they do not commit the crime themselves. So for example, okay, Lindsay, Emily, myself, we rob a bank. Lindsay's the getaway driver. I'm holding the door, and Emily has a gun on the teller. Like how I made Emily the
Yeah. I'm just the driver.
Emily's the one who's demanding the money. She's the one that pulled the gun on the teller. But all three of us are equally guilty, even though you, Lindsay, never even stepped in the bank.
Never even went in the building.
That's accomplice liability.
Okay.
Not to bring it back around, but that sounds like what happens in Good Girls. Which is funny.
Because you can watch that on NBC and Netflix. So in the documentary, Brian Stevenson, who is the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative, explains that there's a long history of this accomplice liability. Like he said, for example, they wouldn't just lynch the person who was accused of doing something criminal. They'd lynch their family members. They'd lynch neighbors.
Wow.
And in this case, prosecutors felt that regardless that Nate hadn't pulled the trigger, he was an accomplice that had helped plan and lure the officers there and inside the house. So therefore, he was just as culpable.
What if Lindsay drove the car away? Would she still be culpable? What if like halfway through she was like, I can't do this and just like bounced?
I don't know.
That'd I'm be, only asking because you're the one in the car, for, not because I think you're going to bounce.
That would be a great question for
leave
Grant.
Leave me at gunpoint.
I mean,
bye, bitch.
The deciding factor in this is intent and, like, and we'll get to it in a little bit, but, like, if you, like, the conspiracy, if you conspired to do it. Conspired
to commit a crime.
So, yeah, I think you would. I mean, that really would be a question for Grant, but I think you could be at least charged with it.
Is this kind of the Deep South area?
This is fucking Birmingham, Alabama. Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. So Carrie's trial was first. And at trial, Carrie claimed self-defense. He never denied killing the officers. And to be fair, the windows of the drug house had been covered over, so it was perpetually dark in there. He'd mixed alcohol and a sleeping pill, and he'd just woken up to a commotion. He sees Nate holding his face in pain, and then all of a sudden guns are pointed at him. Like, I am in no way excusing what Carrie Spencer did,
but
I do understand how a jury might be swayed that, and the jurors also heard about, you know, the supposed arrangement with Curly and RoboCop and all of that. So in the end, jurors did find Carrie guilty, but they did not recommend the death sentence. They had recommended life in prison. Life in prison without parole, I should say. Okay. Now, at that time in Alabama, the judge had the authority to overrule the jury's recommendation. And in this case, that's exactly what he did.
Yep.
Circuit Judge Tommy Nail said that the horrors of the crime outweighed the jury's recommendation of life imprisonment without parole, telling Carrie, may God have mercy on your soul. He later stated that this was, quote, this was the only right thing to do for justice to be done.
If you've been listening to us for a while, you probably know that all three of us are obsessed with our dogs. Something you might not know is Tori and I actually met through a rescue organization. Between myself, Tori, and Lindsay, we have 9 dogs, so you know what that means. We need a lot of toys in our house. We are so excited to announce that we have partnered with BarkBox. I have been a loyal BarkBox customer for, I think, 5 or 6 years now. My dogs are crazy, insane chewers, so I actually had to upgrade them to their Super Chewer box, and my dogs are obsessed with it. They literally recognize the package and, like, growl at me until I open it, and they get a new one every single month. They know, you guys. They know. I know Tori and Lindsay just signed up for theirs, and their dogs are loving it. I'm telling you, the people probably love the toys more than the dogs, but I don't even care. It's the cutest thing you've ever seen, watching them get so excited over new toys. Check out the link in our show notes to get double the amount of toys in your first box when you sign up for BarkBox today. Your doggos will thank you.
Nate's trial was next, and honestly, they went into it feeling pretty confident. I mean, even though the judge had overruled the jury sentencing recommendation, the jury had at least felt that the actual shooter wasn't worthy of the death penalty. Mm. So surely they wouldn't impose a sentence like that on the guy that just happened to be there mm-hmm. and didn't kill anyone. Mm-hmm. Especially when you had the convicted shooter, right? So now mm-hmm. at this point, Carrie's already been tried. He's already been sentenced to death. He has nothing to gain. And he still is adamant that Nate had nothing to do with it. So 14 people would end up being selected for the jury. 12 jurors, two alternates. Only two of the 14 were African-American.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Now, African-Americans are in the majority in Birmingham. I was
going to say, yeah.
So how does Nate end up with a jury that's more than 80% white? Brian Stevenson said, this is not by accident. This is the product of prosecutors using peremptory discretion to specifically exclude people of color. In a trial, each side, so prosecutor and defense attorney, have a certain number of vetoes that they can use where they do not have to give an explanation as to why they are releasing that juror.
What? Is that still a thing?
What?
I don't understand. If it's supposed to be, like, justice for all...
If you think a juror is gay, no, you don't like gay people, you can just be like, veto.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to explain.
And have to say that that's why you're releasing them. At trial, the story was basically what we'd already gone through for each side. Prosecution came out swinging from the very beginning and was just hammering the idea that Nate and Carrie had planned or conspired to lure the officers into the apartment in order to ambush them. Prosecutor Mara Searles told the jury that the men, quote, wanted them trapped. Nate, quote, was the bait, and that Carrie, quote, was the hook. Nate had been in verbal altercations with the officers, and in the past, he did have a past of pettier crimes. So obviously, he was totally a low-life, cop-hating criminal. If Nate had just cooperated with a completely valid warrant, then this whole scenario would never have happened. Now, I take issue with the majority of what the prosecutor said, but that last line, if I was a juror, it's hard for me to argue.
That seems like the most possible because there's an evidence of a fucking warrant. There's not just this person ran.
Right. Okay, so now, conversely, the defense was like, and I'm pulling a Lindsay here, sure, my client doesn't make the best decisions. He has a big mouth that he should probably keep shut, but it's ridiculous to think that he lured them there. And just having a potty mouth doesn't make you a murderer. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly what they said.
Yeah.
I'm paraphrasing Lindsay style.
It's more fun.
And one thing, okay, so one thing for me that I think should have been a much bigger deal than it was that the fact that the police denied that the reason Nate turned and ran farther back into the house was because he was maced. That's why. So he was at the door. Motherfuckers maced him. And
which he caused him to
turn and run. Now, the police officers testified that he was not maced. However, When the defense went through the thousands of photographs from the crime scene, they found pictures that showed the empty mace canister by a door on the other side of the room and one of the officer's belts showing the missing mace canister. Mm. So
they proved that they perjured themselves. Awesome. Love that. Love that for you.
Yeah.
You know, I had a lot more hope in the system before starting this podcast.
It's so fucking true.
I really thought if I ever was in trouble for something and I didn't do it, I wholeheartedly would have believed that I would come out on the other side. And you know, I am not so sure.
The 14 jurors had been sequestered, like, this whole trial. And I think it was about a 2 to 2.5 week trial, I think. But they had been sequestered, and they also they knew the two of them were alternates, but nobody knew who the alternates were. And they didn't get to know until both sides had rested and they were being sent to deliberate. Christina Bishop, who was one of the two African-American jurors, was dismissed as an alternate.
Jesus fucking Christ.
She said she went right back to the hotel. She was like, I didn't even stay. She's like, I went back to the hotel. And she's like, I was relieved and disappointed, like, all at the same time. Sure. It was just, like, this overwhelming emotion. So while deliberating, like, one of the jurors, Curtis Crane, asked about the fact that Nate didn't fire the weapon. He was told that the law says if you're involved in a crime and you don't actually do the crime, but you're part of the conspiracy, you're as guilty as the person doing the actual murders. And he was like, well, if that's what the law says, that makes up my mind about the way that I'm going to vote. And he also said that he felt at the time that, like, he said Nate would, like, anytime they were being excused, that Nate would look at them and make direct eye contact with each one of them. And he felt that that was intimidating. He thought he was doing it in an intimidating way. Oh my God, but conversely, right, conversely, Christina Bishop stated that she felt that Nate's demeanor during the entire trial was just one of defeat. And, I mean, granted, I didn't witness the whole trial. I'm only seeing, you know, the clips that I saw on YouTube and different news, you know, like newscasts and this documentary. But from the clips that I saw, I felt the same way. He looked like he had just.
Oh, he was he like, looked I'm so not sad and just given up. This. Yeah.
Like, he's yeah. Like,
he knew.
Yeah.
Because I was looking at the pictures of him and they showed him in court.
I think so, too. I think, and I say this in a little bit, but I really think that he was just like, I'm a black guy in Alabama accused of killing three cops.
I'm not going to. Yep.
Like, I don't think he had a lot of hope. Juror Chris McAlpine said that they actually had to come back out a few times to have the law reread to them and explained to them before they made their final decision. Both Chris and Curtis at least seemed to believe that under the law, they had to find Nate guilty. But that means that these jurors believed that Nate was part of a conspiracy to lure the officers to the home, which they initially showed up unannounced. You know, like, they showed up at 10:30, and the co-conspirator had exonerated Nate multiple times with nothing to gain for it. Like, how can you, you know? And so I just have this feeling that they didn't understand really what it meant that Nate would have had to have conspired. And I don't understand how they couldn't believe after it was proven that the police had lied and tried to cover up the fact that they maced Nate, which is what caused him to run back into the house. How could he have been luring them?
If anything, they were luring him to let them into the house.
Right.
Yeah.
But other jurors felt, too, that there were things that were brought up that they thought were questionable, but the defense didn't object or like, defend him. And so that led them to believe, I think that that led them to believe that it was like, well, if these things were untrue, she would have objected to it.
Yeah.
And so in the end, the jury unanimously found Nate guilty of capital murder. Oh my God. When it came to sentencing, some of Nate's bad decisions were really highlighted by the prosecutors. They introduced a letter that Nate had written to Curley's wife. Oh, now, the letter was a protestation that he was innocent, and it didn't matter what any of the families thought or wanted, but it came off really creepy, it was described by the media as being threatening.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
His attorneys acknowledged that this was a really dumb thing for him to do, and it did him no favors, but they were like, look, you've got a young, frustrated kid in this situation, and yeah, he did something stupid. He should have kept his mouth shut.
He sounds naive.
Very, very naive. Which, I mean... Yeah, and I mean, he looks naive. Anyway, prosecutors then brought in Curley's wife, who told the jury that that Nate needed the death penalty. Nate took the stand, and he was asked if he had anything to say to the families or to the jury to help them make their decision. Despite being prepped by his attorneys on what he should say, Nate instead said, well, I don't really have no feelings about the officers. I really didn't have nothing to do with it, but if they feel they need to take my blood, then fine. If they be satisfied with that, then it's fine. And I think that goes to show just how defeated he was.
Yeah.
But the jury took it as him being completely non-remorseful. Chris McAlpine was so disappointed, and he was like, that's all you could muster up, given up what we're, you know, fixing to decide here about your life? And on one hand, I understand where the juror's coming from, mm-hmm. but I think it's an incorrect interpretation as to what Nate was really saying.
They're so don't even understand his life in general that they are assuming he will react just like they would react, right. And that's not how humans are.
No, and again, not taking into effect that this is a black man.
Exactly.
And at this point has now been found guilty of murdering 3 white cops in Alabama.
If you're a podcast junkie like we are, you've probably considered starting your own. Whether you're looking for a new marketing channel, have a message you want to share with the world, or just think it would be fun to have your own talk show, podcasting is an easy, inexpensive, and fun way to expand your reach online. Buzzsprout is hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you succeed. If you've ever considered starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start one. Follow the link in our show notes to let Buzzsprout know that we sent you, and you'll get a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan. All you need is a microphone and a quiet place. Listen, I'm literally on my bed with a blanket over my head talking to you right now. I promise it's easy and you can do it almost anywhere. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message out to the world and start your podcast today.
During deliberation with the 12 jurors, 8 wanted the death penalty. And of those 8, 2 were not willing to discuss any other possibility. 2 were at least undecided. And so the jury recommendation came back 10-2 for the death penalty in less than 2.5 hours. I want to take this moment to remind everyone that the man that actually murdered the officers and took 100% responsibility for it, that jury only recommended life.
That is so wild.
At the time of the trial, only 3 states allowed for non-unanimous recommendation for the death penalty, and today Alabama remains the only one. 29 states that have the death penalty. And in 28 of them, you have to have a unanimous decision from the jury in order to recommend the death penalty. Okay. Sorry, it's really heavy. I told you this one's like a fucking bummer. Nate sat on death row for almost 15 years. Jesus. On January 30th of 2020, he was presented with a 1-page document advising him that his execution date would be March 5th of 2020 and requested information on what funeral home he needed to put in the contact information for the funeral home that he wanted to use.
Was there a stay of execution because it was March 2020?
Keep in mind, Carrie is still sitting on death row, and he still hasn't gotten a 1-page document. Now, according to the Times article I read, Carrie opted for a new experimental method of execution, some type of gas, and it's only been approved for use in Alabama, but they haven't finalized the procedure on how they will administer it. And so that has bought Carrie some additional time because they're still arguing about how they're going to do it. So he's like, oh, sure. Okay. I'll take that one. About a month before Nate's scheduled execution date, attorney Lauren, I think it's Farino. She's a young attorney. She's 30 years old, never tried a capital case, like never involved in a capital case. But she received an email from Project Hope, and it was about abolishing the death penalty, and it contained Nate's story. So she had forwarded it to her mom, Elena Starr, who had developed a budding interest in capital punishment. And I believe she's also her daughter's paralegal, which I think is really cute.
That's cute.
But anyway, a few days after Lauren sent it to her mom calls and she's like, I went down to the courthouse and I got the transcripts of this trial. And she's like, I have gone through the court summaries and something like this shit is way off. Like, this shit is not right. And so they went down the rabbit hole, Tory style.
Oh, my God. What was that you just did to your face? What is that?
It's me flicking my goat hairs.
Okay, my goat.
Okay, so when they came across Bubba's affidavit for the protection payoffs, that was like, this is it. It was like, this is, okay, got it.
Here it is.
And so Lauren and Elena contacted Nate's legal team, and she was just like, I just want to offer our assistance. And they responded, and they were like, hey, would you guys be able to help with the clemency petition? So that's what they did. And so they started to motion. They were asking for more time so that a new legal team could come on and put forward the information that they felt should have been done at the beginning. Because they all knew, like, this should have gone horribly wrong. And then Nate's sister connected with Lauren, and they went to the media, and then the story, like, blew up. And you had...
I vaguely remember the three cops, but that's all I remember.
You had the Martin Luther King Jr. the Third, Kim Kardashian, O.J. Simpson, T.I. all came out publicly trying to bring attention to the case and advocating for Nate. Now, there was...
I do remember this.
Well, see, there was Julius Jones, which was really recent, and there was Rodney Reed. There have been a couple.
I remember Kim Kardashian specifically about it because she said he didn't even pull the trigger.
Yeah, that was it. She has actually advocated, and you guys know I am no Kim Kardashian fan, but I do respect the fact that she has tried to use her. She's working really hard. Yeah, and like this is like.
I mean, she passed the bar. She's a lawyer.
She met with Donald Trump multiple times to try and do stays of execution for people.
She has done a lot of amazing advocacy work. When he was
the president.
So I do have to, like, I've got to give her all due credit for that. But anyway, they also have released this, it gave me chills, this video of just, like, normal people saying, I had as much to do with the shooting as Nate Woods. And then it's another person going, I had, and then towards the end of it, it's going, you know, I had as much to do with the shooting as Nate Woods. Are you going to execute me too? Mm-hmm. And it just, oh my God, it gave me the chill. So that got circulated. And then they had a protest at the Capitol building in Montgomery, Alabama, and delivered protest letters to Governor Kay Ivey. That fucking bitch. Let me just tell
you. She's the one that you tagged, right?
Sure did.
Tagged her on Facebook and said, shame on you.
Oh, that's right.
Show did. So on the day of the scheduled execution, because they did not. They would not give them more time.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's their fucking...
sacrificial motherfucking lamb. So on the day of the scheduled execution, Lauren stayed in Birmingham to manage communications. At 5:30 p.m., they got word that the governor would consider clemency if they could get one of the victim's family members to ask for a halt to the execution. The execution was scheduled for 6 p.m. that evening.
Oh, my God.
So they had 30 minutes to try to get the governor would consider. So kind of about the same time, Lauren had received an email from Kimberly Chisholm, who was one of the sisters of RoboCop Harley. In the email, she said she wanted Nate to know that she had forgiven him for whatever role he had played in her brother's death. And Lauren was like, oh my God, will you please call me? And Lauren was desperately trying to get a hold of the governor's office. And while she had been told the governor would consider clemency if she could get a victim's relative to stand up for him, they didn't give her a number to call. So she's got like 22 minutes and she's like,
trying to find a way.
So I'm going to play for you guys.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
Sorry, I've got to find it.
Me upset.
And I do. It is going to make you upset. And I want you to know that if you do watch the documentary, because I stole this straight from there, not going to lie, and I'm advocating that people go and watch this documentary. But if you watch it, it's the first thing that you hear, which is why I was like, wait, what?
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are things going for you?
I have been working on the case of Nathaniel Woods. I basically uncovered a lot of horrible things that went wrong with his trial, and we truly, truly believe that he's innocent, and we are trying to stop the execution that is set to happen in 35 minutes.
I realize you've got 35 minutes. Let me make a phone call or two.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hello? Is this Lori?
Yes, it is.
Hi, honey. This is Kim. Hi, sister.
Thank you for calling me. I just found out that the Attorney General wants a statement from someone who was connected to the victims asking for mercy for Nate. And that's sort of the condition of granting reprieve.
I think they need to do that. He didn't kill Noah. He didn't kill my brother. He was just at the wrong place at the wrong time.
If I can get you in touch with someone at the governor's office, would you convey that message to them?
Yes, I will.
It may just connect. If it does, can I just call you back at this number?
Yes, honey, you sure can.
Okay, thank you.
You have reached the Alabama Department of Credit. Please look into the following job.
I need a direct number.
Thank you
for
calling the office of the Alabama Attorney General, State Marshal. Terminal hours are 8 a.m. to 5 a.m. You have reached Governor Abbey's legal office. We're eager to be.
Okay, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Don't give up. We're getting close. Don't give up.
That's her mom talking. Yeah.
Oh my God, that just filled my body with so much anxiety.
My God.
Okay, with 22 minutes to go to the execution, the Supreme Court stepped in and ordered a temporary stay of 2 hours. Oh my God. To give the governor time to review. Well, I'm getting real emotional.
My God. Squeeze your butt cheeks together. It always works. Squeeze your butt cheeks together.
So the two-hour time frame was supposed to give the governor time to review and determine if she would grant clemency. Most people were celebrating, but Curly's daughter was not. Like, I mean, she was in a panic, and she was just like, she was terrified that they might let him go. And she's like, no, he's the entire reason. And she told, this was this morning when I was like trying to rush to finish. I didn't say where I got this, but somewhere she had said, it's just he broke the law, he made a bad choice, and that was his punishment. So meanwhile, while this was going on all day, Nate was meeting with his family and saying his final goodbyes. His father recounts their meeting as follows. I was sitting there at the table with him, and he told me these words. He said, Dad, I love you. He said, but when y'all walk out of this gate today, he said, I'm going to walk out with y'all. But y'all is not going to know it. And he said, I'm going to be all right. I'm going to be a free man when I come out of this gate. Lauren was finally able to get a statement through to the governor, so all they could do was wait. At 7:35, Governor Ivey determined that clemency was unwarranted. And just minutes later, the Supreme Court lifted the temporary stay, allowing the execution to continue. And it's so weird because I didn't even cry until right now. And it was so sad too. And I didn't put it in here, but one of the things that I read was Lauren, it was like at 8:01 or something. Lauren sent an email to one of the attorneys and was like, it's over. I just can't imagine pouring like that much and knowing that something is so wrong.
And not the whole system just like stopping you at every fucking thing.
They asked Nate if he had any final words, and he just said no. And we'll link the New York Times article. It goes into kind of detail about him like lifting his head and like, and I was just like, nope, not including that. Never get through it. At 8:38 p.m., they began the execution, and at 9:01. Nathaniel Woods, a man who killed no one, is declared dead. Nate's sister, Heavenly, you know, talks about the trauma that this caused their family and about still being angry. Like, she's like, I still am just so angry. Oh, like, yeah. I don't know how to not be so angry. And, you know, I hadn't really thought, because I've always been anti-death penalty, and there are definitely cases where, like Rodney Alcala, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
You know, there are cases that even I am just like, yeah, let's just, you know, out of society.
Let's just go. Mm-hmm.
But for many, many reasons, I have been anti the death penalty, but this is one that I never really thought of. How the pain of an execution can devastate and ripple through another family. And then I'm like, is that justice? Does it lessen, like, is it worth lessening the grief of one family to cause that much grief to another? Like, is that justice? Is it revenge? Like, and then that other family, like, they have no recourse. There's nobody for them to go and get revenge against, you know? I just don't know.
That's a good point that you don't think about the consequences.
I mean, you just, you know, you think about somebody else, this person's a monster, and this is the punishment, but you don't think about the fact that there's somebody's son, brother, whatever. And, you know, I think one of the reasons why I like that, what's that show that I love on Discovery that I got you hooked on?
Where Evil Lives, like, Here?
Evil Lives Here.
Oh, yeah.
You know, kind of like that, because that's usually family members being like, he was fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, whatever. But, like, you know, even thinking back to, like, the Werewolf of Spokane, where they were just, like, the person that he ended up was not the person that I knew as a child or, you know, whatever. But those families still grieve,
still their family.
So I just, a couple of things that I felt were really, I just wanted to mention. 87% of the executions in Alabama are African-Americans. Again, Brian Stevenson, who I just, like, I want this guy to teach a class, and I would go to every single one. Like, he's amazing. But he reminds us in the documentary that laws are predominantly made by white men, and then the judges are white, the prosecutors are white, and the juries are mostly white.
The government
is mostly, the people make, you know, so... you know, but also to remember that these disparities are not unique to Alabama. And until these disparities are addressed, we will continue to see, as we always have, situations like this. And he said the mindset is still evident in our law, and that law of accomplice liability is what got Mr. Woods on death row. Federal law in every other state except Alabama, so 29 states that have the death penalty, Alabama is the only state that does not require a unanimous decision for the death penalty. Had this crime occurred in any other state, Nate Woods would not have been executed.
It's true.
If the alternate juror had been on the jury and voted, you know, had not voted for the death penalty, the vote would have been 9-3. That wouldn't have been enough, and Nate Woods would not have been executed. As a side note, in 2020, Florida's state Supreme Court ruled that a unanimous decision was not required for the death penalty, reversing an earlier decision. But then this caused chaos for all the cases that were in progress at the time, because they didn't know who would fall under the old rules and who would fall under the new rules. And from what I could find out, I did confirm with my amazing sister-in-law, who is a lawyer in Florida, that the legislature has not changed that back. So the state Supreme Court ruled that it's not required, but the legislature hasn't changed it back. So as of right now, they do still require a unanimous decision for a jury to recommend the death penalty and sentencing. It's also noteworthy here, especially speaking about the fact that this is not a problem solely, you know, centralized in Alabama, that Florida, as of 2020, was the state with the highest number of death row exonerations. 29 Florida death row inmates have been exonerated. According to the American Bar Association, that is approximately one for every three prisoners executed in the state in the modern death penalty era.
What in the fuck?
Only 29 states still have the death penalty. 26 of those states have accomplice liability, where an accomplice can be sentenced to death. So,
does Washington have? I can't remember.
I think we do, but I'm not sure.
Do we have what?
Accomplice liability.
Or the execution, that thing. That
death penalty?
That thing.
I don't think there was a stay of execution, like, a couple years ago. And I think it's still there in Washington. Like, when 2020 happened, they did a stay of execution, and I don't think it's been lifted.
Yeah.
No one in Washington has been executed. But I think they're doing away with it anyway.
Right.
Okay.
So, were the cops dirty? I don't know. They were never formally accused, and frankly, I don't think it matters. I mean, I think their deaths, and in particular, Officer Bennett's death, I mean, everybody that has died in this is a fucking tragedy, you know?
Didn't need to happen this way.
It did not need to happen. It did not need to happen this way. And I guess, and I don't want to make it seem like I have all of this sympathy for Nate and that I didn't have it for the officers. I didn't delve as deeply into their backgrounds. I think that it is always a tragedy when an officer loses their life. And also, not that I don't mourn their loss, but my point, I think the reason that I'm so upset about this is that Nate didn't do anything.
Right.
Yeah.
He didn't do anything.
Evidence, like so much evidence.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Nate was a saint by any means. And I say this with no disrespect to the officer's family, but I don't feel that Nate deserved the death penalty. Punishment, sure, but the loss of his life, no. In one of his letters that he wrote from prison, he said, "I know I've done wrong in the past, and I still do to this very day because I'm not perfect. But murder or attempting to take the life of another human being is truly not me." Mm. This case was a huge bummer to cover. There's no winner. It's just pain and trauma all around. And so one of his other prison writings seemed to sum up how Nate was feeling. And it impacted me greatly. He said, "There are no virgins within these walls because life has fucked us all."
Oh, my God. Whoa. That tattooed on my forehead.
Carrie Spencer is still on death row, God, awaiting execution.
That's wild.
And Nate Wood's family is still advocating for his exoneration. It's one of the most fucked up, horrifying things that I've ever
researched. And it literally happened, like, 5 minutes ago.
That's why I was just like, so. Again, sorry for crying. I have no idea where that came from. That just was like.
We all cried.
Okay, well, that was horrible.
Listen to the new Patreon that I did. It's just as miserable.
It really is.
Nobody won. Nope.
Everybody's fucked. Remember who you are and what you represent. Always ask for an attorney.
Ask for an attorney. Say nothing. Say nothing.
I'm going to go watch The OC now.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Wow, we're getting off here. Go to Patreon. Follow us on Instagram. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts.
Okay, bye.
Sayonara.
Sayonara. Hey, Weirdlings, have you ever listened to a podcast and thought, man, I could do this? Well, guess what? That's exactly what we did, and you can too. Podcasting is a fun, inexpensive, and easy way to expand your reach online. Whether you have a message that you want to share with the world, just think having your own talk show would be cool, or you're looking for a new marketing or revenue stream, Buzzsprout has you covered. We can confirm that they're hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed on all of the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping all of us succeed. Join 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout, and let's get your message out to the world. If you're ready to get started on your podcast, follow the link in our show notes and you'll get a $20 Amazon gift card, and it helps support our show too. So what are you waiting for? Start your new podcast today.